Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 5th of February 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say today we have a special guest with us, someone who I've wanted to get on the show for quite some time since I first heard him on a Red Ice interview last year. It was such a good interview, I had to listen to it twice. I then found out after that that he's an anthropologist who specialises in religion and evolutionary psychology with loads of interests outside of that in history and politics. He's the author of 15 books and the host of a particularly good internet TV channel called The Jolly Heretic. And of course, it is Professor Edward Dutton. Ed, thank you very much for coming on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Yeah, it's been long time. Long time no see. Yeah. It's been a while.
So, yes.
What was it? September 2019, wasn't it, when we met?
It was, so, when you raised the roof off with your speech there.
You came and got me from Manchester Railway Station. It was very kind of you. And how are you doing? Anyway, what's been going on in your life?
Well, I've been doing very well, actually. We seem to be getting more and more listeners at Radio Albion. We've now got Mark here with Patriotic Weekly Review. And it was actually after listening to your interview on Patriotic Weekly Review, where you were talking about your book on Churchill's headmaster, that I thought, well, this is a really good subject here that the listeners at Radio Albion would be interested in, because we've had a series on Churchill. We did a series called Churchill's Body Count, where we looked into all the people that had actually been massacred by him. And we've also been concentrating a lot on the British Empire recently. We have a Greatest Britain series where we've covered people like General Gordon, Colin Campbell, Baden Powell, and we've just recently done Sir Edward Buller as well. And I noted that this book seemed to cover all of it. It's not actually one of the ones I've read. I've read How to Judge People by What They Look Like, Race Differences in Ethnocentrism, and I'm just in the middle of Making Sense of Race. And this book, Churchill's Headmaster, the sadist who nearly saved the British Empire, seems to cover all these issues that we've been talking about here at Radio Albion. So I'd really like to get into that and hear your thoughts on Churchill, on the Victorian school system, and particularly on this headmaster, and also why it was that you think that if Churchill had stayed there with his headmaster for a little bit longer, then we may still have the British Empire.
Mm. Well, it was inspired by, reading about, obviously what I was brought up to think was almost like a hero worship of Winston Churchill. I mean, this is changing a bit now due to the rise of wokeness. But in my own childhood, it was, you know, Churchill was hero worshipped by the generation of my grandparents and people like that who fought in the war, or at least by a lot of them. And he was voted in whatever it was, the early 2000s, as the greatest Briton. And he's regarded as the founder of the modern nation. And then when I started to read more recently critical accounts with regard to Churchill, which they're out there. All the information is there. It's just that those kinds of accounts are not promoted by the mainstream media. So you get these ludicrous books such as Boris Johnson's book, The Churchill Factor, which is this hagiography of Churchill. And there's so many books like this, and so many popular books, and all they do is just rehash other popular books, usually without stating their sources and without citing sources and whatever, where you just have this hagiography of Churchill. And if there's any admission of anything negative about him, whether that he's a heavy drinker or a bit of a rogue, then it's kind of played down and sugar-coated, and he's just this wonderful person. And so it was when I started with a skeptical eye looking into this, and it came to my attention that no, that this is a complete myth. And there are many myths about Churchill, but this idea that he was this wonderful person that took Britain into this war to defend democracy, and that it was a necessary war, and that if we hadn't, we had to go into it to defend democracy, and that we were under threat from Nazi Germany, and that it was the only thing he could have done, and whatever, it's all rubbish. And what transpired from my reading of people like David Charmley and various other people that are critical of Churchill, that what you're dealing with is a person who was basically a narcissist and a psychopath and a drunk, who liked danger and took huge risks with other people's lives, including in the Gallipoli campaign. Before the war as well, he would take these incredible risks. This is marked throughout his childhood. He's obviously some sort of psychopathic or narcissistic type of person. He was a gambler, and by 1930, he was out of office, and he had to maintain Chartwell, which is this stately home in Kent. And so he had to come up with ways of doing this. And so he'd write these, his memoirs, for example, which I found not particularly true. He needed money. And so he took funding from a group called the Focus, which was a combination of trade unionists and Jewish interests and people like this. And they were pushing for war against Nazi Germany. And so, of course, he started pushing for war against Nazi Germany. That's what he did. There didn't need to be a war with Germany. It wasn't really in our interests to have a war with Germany. They weren't threatening us, but that's what he did. So he was motivated basically by money and by the need to live this incredibly extravagant lifestyle that he lived, that he could no longer afford, because from 1930 he was no longer a member of the government, just a backbench MP. And so he used all of his oratorical ability and all of his skills, and he was obviously a very skilled person, to try and take us into war. And that's what he did. And what seems to me from what I argue in the book, and what these other historians argue, is that there was no reason to go to war. We weren't rescuing democracy. Poland, I mean, there's many good things about Poland, and I'm a fan of Poland, but Poland at the time, to be clear, was a military dictatorship. And it was just as much of a dictatorship as Germany, and it persecuted its Germans just as Germany persecuted its Jews. There was no need inherently to go into the war. After all, the Irish didn't go into the war, the Spanish didn't go into the war. Hitler attempted to negotiate peace, it turns out, with Churchill once the war had started, once Churchill was prime minister, but Churchill wouldn't have it, and he used the fact that a stray bomb fell over Rotherhithe to say, okay, that's it, we can blitz Germany, this is a full-on war. Hitler tried to negotiate peace, but Churchill wouldn't have it, because it seems he loved war. He even, it seems, sent Rudolf Hess to try and negotiate peace, using his and he allowed a dignified withdrawal at Dunkirk, which didn't have to, because there's evidence that he didn't particularly want a war. He wanted to stop this. What he wanted to do was have a free hand in the East. And this shouldn't affect us. I mean, Poland did all kinds of things in the East, taking land from the Ukraine and whatever, and we didn't interfere. So all of these things made me question the mythology about Churchill. And I thought, well, if that aspect of Churchill is wrong, what else is wrong? What else might be a myth? What else might be untrue? And that's when I struck upon the idea, from having read a few books about it and also having watched the 1970 film Young Winston, that the idea that his headmaster, his prep school headmaster, Herbert Snaid Kinnersley, was a, in the words of Anna Seber, one of the hagiographers of Churchill, a perverted sadist who would birch prep school children aged between 8 and 13 on their bare buttocks until they bled and until there were explosions of excreta on the walls, and he would then be sexually aroused by cleaning the excreta off. This is what she says. This idea, maybe this isn't true. Maybe this is wrong. Maybe this is a myth, because he's an enemy of Churchill. Churchill didn't like him, of course, hated him. And so maybe that is itself untrue. And so that's what got me interested in researching the life of Churchill's headmaster.
Well, certainly some symmetry there, isn't there? Churchill is made out to be this wonderful guy, and he's actually a bad guy. And then we hear that his headmaster was this sadist. So it would make sense that maybe there was a lie about that as well. So that's what Churchill was doing in his wilderness years. Then he was really sort of beating the drums for war against Germany to please this focus group, you think?
Yeah, to get money. I think that's evidently what he was doing. And at the time, he was considered to be, has been, you know, he'd already been Chancellor of the Exchequer and Home Secretary. And it was considered that's it. He's out. He's no good. He's finished. But that was how he was seen at the time. He was seen as a kind of a buccaneer. He was seen as unreliable. I can see in many ways why Boris Johnson wrote a biography of him, because he obviously, I would suspect, he kind of identifies with him. And you can see that there are in some ways parallels between Churchill and him, you know, charismatic, risk taker, all this sort of thing. There are some things that aren't parallels, but those things are important parallels. So anyway, so then I started researching it and I realized there really hadn't been much on this guy, Churchill's headmaster. So I started looking into the various Churchill books, and he basically becomes, you know, as time will exaggerate things, you know, if you want to people to pay attention to you, then you exaggerate things from what's already known. And so over the years, Churchill's headmaster has become worse and worse and worse. So in the 1970s, there was a book called The English Vice, which was on corporal punishment in the history of England. And it asserted that Churchill's headmaster was a sadist. And then it just gets worse from there until we get to this explosions of excreta, which he'd be sexually aroused by cleaning off, and he was a perverted sadist and whatever that you have in this Anna Sever book. So I thought, well, let's go back to the sources. You know, what are the sources about this guy? What are the actual sources? And that's what I did. And that was a bit of an eye-opener, because then it starts to fall apart. The worst accounts of him are put forth by the most unreliable sources. And with the reliable sources, yes, they admit that he was severe, even by the flogging standards of his time. But it must be understood that flogging in that way was completely the norm at these boys' prep schools. In fact, it was more severe at prep schools than it was at the public schools. And in a far more balanced picture comes across. Churchill, in his book that he published during his wilderness years, My Early Life, says that Snaid Kinnersley would beat people worse than anything at Eton or at the reform schools under the Home Office. That's what he said. So I looked into that, and another source stated that a typical Snaid Kinnersley beating was 15 strokes of the birch, which would be enough to cause the child to bleed. But that was actually on the harsh side for these kinds of prep schools, but it was the norm. Churchill was exaggerating. It turns out that Eton and Rugby, 15 to 20 strokes was not infrequent, and reform schools likewise. And Churchill would have known that, because Churchill went to Harrow himself, and his son went to Eton, and Churchill was Home Office Minister, and therefore in charge of reform schools. So that he was exaggerating how severely he was beaten by this headmaster, because he disliked him, basically. So that's that source. And then you have a guy called Roger Fry. Roger Fry was a famous art critic, very much a sort of modernist or conveyor of modernist art. And who was friends with Virginia Woolf. And when Roger Fry died, Virginia Woolf wrote up his kind of autobiography, which she censored a little bit. And Roger Fry, this is another thing that was argued in these hagiographies, that Snaid Kinnersley was uneducated, that he was a sadist, and this is the source for this idea that he beat a child till he excreted. So I looked into that, and I found out that Roger Fry asserted that Snaid Kinnersley was uneducated. That's not true. Snaid Kinnersley had a doctorate in law, which was incredibly rare at the time to have a PhD. And he died in 1886, and he got a PhD the previous year. He had published a number of books as well on Latin and Greek. So the uneducated is not true. He doesn't really provide evidence that Snaid Kinnersley was a sadist. He says that he suspects he might have been, but he doesn't sort of show that he was. Although it might be a bit of projectionism, because one of the things that Fry writes about in his memoir is because he was a head boy, and the head boy and the deputy head boy would have to take the children to be beaten and hold them down while the headmaster beat them. And he talks about how one time he came back from a beating and he had an erection. So Fry may have been a sadist. And then there's the thing that the beating till he excreted. That turns out to be one particular incident, which Fry reports, which, I mean, it may have happened. but it turns out that was far from unique in these circumstances. And that seems to have been Sarah Ferguson, the Duchess of York's great-grandfather, I discovered. That's who that was. So that's that one. Then there was a source called Edmund Backhouse. He writes this thing, this unpublished memoir, where he argues that Snake Kiddersley was homosexual, had homosexual desires for the boys, and that he died while beating him, while beating a boy. And then the boys that were there took the birch rod and stuffed it up Snake Kinnersley's anus. Now, this is totally untrue because Snake Kinnersley died in November 1886 at his father's house in Birmingham. So this is a complete lie. Backhouse was not present because Backhouse had left the school by then anyway. And Backhouse is an incredibly unreliable source who wrote this book there was a book about him called The Hermit of Peking, which showed that Backhouse was basically, that Backhouse used to write about all his connections with the Chinese royal family and whatever, and by Hugh Trevor Roper. And it turns out he was a fantasist. So Backhouse, we can dismiss. He was a complete fantasist. So, and as for the reliability of Fry, there's various problems I found with the reliability of Roger Fry as well. He's highly neurotic, and people that are neurotic will tend to remember negative things more strongly and be partial in their memories. And so there's reason to doubt the reliability of Roger Fry as well. And also he evidently seems to dislike Snake Kinnersley. But when it comes to the more balanced ones, you have somebody called Harry von Kessler, who was a German who was at the school, who admitted that Snake Kinnersley beat children severely, but regarded him as inspiring and on a standard with Plato, and was extremely positive about him in lots and lots of ways, which makes sense because, I mean, the school was the most expensive prep school in the country. It even had electricity, which was a new thing at the time. And it seems insane that if the school was as appalling as people like Churchill and Fry and Backhouse make out, that all of the word wouldn't get round. I mean, kids would write home to their parents and tell them what happened. That's another thing they make out. They make out that, people couldn't write home to their parents. They were afraid to tell the parents what happened. That's totally untrue. The kids, Roger Fry wrote home to his parents about the beatings and things that he witnessed. So that's totally untrue as well when the people say that's what was going on. So Kessler is very positive. Somebody called Aubrey Jay, who is the grandfather of Peter Jay, who was married to Jim Callahan. I got in touch with Peter Jay, and he gave me Aubrey's unpublished memoirs. Again, he admits that he birched too freely, but that he was an inspiring, amazing, generous teacher that took them on amazing school trips and wonderful food and things like this. There was somebody called Arthur Bonham Carter, who wrote about how helpful he was in getting him into a good public school. Maurice Baring, who was this left-wing writer, he didn't really see him as he sort of, to some extent, argues that he's inspiring, but he's quite an interesting source because it's quite balanced. And he talks about how, he was over the top with birching, and he seemed to be a bit sort of mentally unstable and childlike and unpredictable. But on the other hand, he was this inspiring teacher and this amazing teacher, and people liked him, and he would take them on the most amazing school trips and do the most extraordinary things, like a funeral for the school rabbit and all of these peculiar things. Even Roger Fry admitted when he died that Snake Kinnersley was, in his words, kind-hearted on the whole. Those were his exact words. I didn't have much respect for him, but he was kind-hearted on the whole. And so what you see is a much more balanced picture of Snake Kinnersley, which is that he was a person of his time, and this was a tradition where there is this beating system, the reasons of which we can go into, but there is this beating system at these prep schools, which he operated overly severely. There's no evidence that he was a sadist. He may have been a sort of caning fetishist, that if he was a sadist, then you'd expect him to be a nasty, sadistic person who would be horrible to people or whatever. But it turns out that no, he wasn't like that at all. He was very generous and kind to people and would do, go out of his way to assist people. It strikes me that he may have had a sort of personality disorder. And I look at this in the book, a sort of borderline personality disorder, because there's evidence of very bizarre behavior where he suddenly sort of flips and becomes very cross. That's consistent with a sort of borderline personality disorder, which, by the way, is itself correlated with fetishes. So there is some evidence there. He married and he never had children as well. But the idea that he was just this absolute perverted sadist just is not consistent with the sources.
It doesn't fit at all. If you have somebody that's running a school, he's obviously there because people think highly of him. And if he's got some of the most upper-class children there at that school, then there's no way that he's going to be mistreating them and birching the children. They used to say, spare the rod and spoil the child. And it was a very important part of a child's education for them to be disciplined. I think where we don't have that today is one of the leading causes of why we have so many problems with young people today, is because they're not disciplined. But the idea of somebody like Churchill, like these upper class people receiving beatings at the hands of their teachers, it's not really something that we think about. But it really makes sense. And I believe you point out that this was necessary because these people were so high up to give them a sense of what it was like to suffer in the world. So they had some empathy with the lower classes. Is that correct?
I mean, if you think about the way that the society operates, we think in terms of an evolution, in terms of something. The other thing I would note before I go on to that is there was a rumor that he was sexually aroused by ginger-haired people. This guy, Stay Kinnersley. And that Churchill had ginger hair. I traced this back to someone called Sir Shane Leslie, and it was an unknown source. So he's just something that someone told him. So this doesn't seem to be reliable. And then there was something that there was an idea that Churchill was beat Churchill so severely that Churchill wounds festered. And this apparently was something that was told to Churchill's niece once removed, when Churchill was an elderly man, by which time he was completely senile and wouldn't have known what he was talking about. Another thing is that the nanny revealed to the mother that he was being beaten after he'd been at school for years, and then he was removed from the school. Well, that's not true. She would have seen him naked and bathed him. So she would have known what was going on for years and years before Churchill was removed. He wasn't removed. People write in these hagiographies, he was removed from the schools because of the beatings. That's not true. It's clearly not true. Would have known about that for years. He was removed from the school because of the fact that he had double influenza, and it was considered better that he should go to a school on the coast near Brighton. And there's just so many other things like that have been just these lies and exaggerations that have developed about Snake Kinnersley, which people are prepared to believe because they'll believe anything because he's an enemy of the cult of Churchill. And so it's impossible for him to be too evil. But I look into all of these things in detail in the book, and they're just not true. But with regards to what you said about the regimen of beatings, basically you have this idea of group selection. So this idea that which the Victorians were very big on. So this idea that you as a group are in an evolutionary battle, basically, with other groups. And so you win that battle of group selection by being high in positive ethnocentrism, high in negative ethnocentrism, basically high in religiousness. And so the upper class become a little bit like a tribe. It's a little bit like a sort of a primitive tribe. You have these rites of passage into adulthood, which you have in these tribes, where they're taken away from the tribe for a period of time, the boys, and they are subjected. They're basically sort of in a very systematic way, kind of brutalized, really, and inculcated with the myths of the tribe and inculcated with ideas of the good of the group, and of the bond is broken with the family so that they are there to be for the good of the group and to be group focused. And then they go back into society as men to run the tribe. And you basically, this is kind of where the public school system came from. And it was consciously modeled on the system in Sparta, where they all, of course, knew Greek and Latin, and they were very familiar with what went on in Sparta. And Plato was a big fan of the Spartans, and Plato said that the upper class should not know their parents. And so it developed out of that idea that if you have these upper class people and they're just allowed to just have their upper class life, like is the case now to some extent, then they're going to just be decadent because they're going to want for nothing. They're never going to have to work. They're never going to have to suffer. They're not going to understand the meaning of hard work, and that you're going to have this decadent society. So that we can't have that. So we have to have them basically subject to a system which is harsh yet stable, a system where there are clear rules, often bizarre and unfair and ludicrous rules, but the point is that they are rules, and it is a system which inculcates them, which almost breaks their inculcates them with a sense of humility, with a sense of that they are subservient to the group, with a sense of that they must do what is good for the group, with a sense of noblesse oblige, harsh yet stable, and what we call a K strategy, a harsh yet stable ecology. And that ecology, if it's harsh yet stable, militates in favour of people having to be cooperative, people having to get on, people following the rules, people putting others before themselves, people putting the group before themselves. That's what a harsh yet stable ecology produces in nature. And so with this instance, it is an attempt to manufacture artificially through the public school system a harsh yet stable environment, because that creates a certain kind of person. It creates a person that is conscientious, that is cooperative, that is agreeable, that will lay down their life for the group, that is not narcissistic, whatever. And therefore it creates this class that is able to run the empire, take risks for the empire, and if necessarily lay down their lives for the empire, inculcated with tradition and religion. And so that's the point of it. And so that's the point of the ritualistic beatings that were such a significant part of the system. And they have to be understood in that context. Indeed, you could argue, Desmond Morris argues this in his book, The Human Zoo, that the origin of corporal punishment, full stop, that is basically a sort of a sublimated sexual thing or whatever with apes. If there is a fight between two apes, then the subservient ape presents its hindquarters to the other ape. And then that's it. It's showing a submission, and thus the fight is dissipated. And that's where this tradition comes from in humans. And then added to that, of course, is the pain of being beaten. So you have to control your emotions. You have to take your punishment like a man. It's about all those kinds of things, teaching people to control their emotions, to cope with pain, to not flinch from pain, and all of these things that are important in a harsh yet stable ecology, and are subsequently then important at a time of war. And they are being trained ultimately to lead a group in a time of war, to be group selected like the Spartans. So that's the point of it. And so it through a combination of these different effects, the idea is to mold them into these basically soldiers that will lead the group.
Can I just say, I think that's a fantastic system for the upper classes. I really don't think that could be beaten. Pun not intended. No. Was that a particularly British system, or was that just European wide?
You do have it to some extent in other countries, in Germany and whatever, but it was taken to a very pronounced degree among the British. The use of this particularly severe corporal punishment, particularly harsh, particularly ritualistic, particularly extended. So when the public school system started, there weren't prep schools, and the prep schools develop, and so therefore the children are sent away from school as young as eight, sent away from home as young as eight, as happened with Churchill, and are boarding at the age of eight, and then are away from home until they leave to go to military academy or university or the army or whatever. You do have it in other countries as well, similar things, of course, in Sparta, in Japan. And then, interestingly, there are certain countries, certain cultures that have been very resistant to abolishing corporal punishment. America is one, Japan is another, the Afrikaans in South Africa were famous for beating their kids, the English is another. And it could be argued that the point of ritualistic corporal punishment in general is to create group selected people. So we have this idea. I did a paper on this recently. It was published in Medical Hypotheses, where I demonstrate that if you control for all factors like the parents being mentally ill and the parents being congenitally violent, and you control for these kinds of factors, control, you have to get rid of those. Because people say, corporal punishment results in the children being violent and being mentally ill. Well, yeah, but that's if parents who are violent and mentally ill are more likely to beat their kids. So you have to control for that. You have to just look at parents that aren't violent, aren't mentally ill. And if you do that, then you find that corporal punishment has positive outcomes in terms of later pro-social behavior. And that makes sense because it's something that's been engaged. But it's not, when I say corporal punishment, I don't mean just smacking a kid around the head. I mean specifically this ritualized corporal punishment that we're talking about, that was not as severe, but that was undergone by at these kinds of schools. There was a fascinating study which found that if non-Christian parents, not controlling for mental illness or anything, if non-Christian parents administer corporal punishment to their kids, it has negative outcomes in terms of mental health and in terms of future behavior. But if Christian parents don't do this to their kids, then it has negative outcomes. And people who are fundamentalist Christians tend to be low in mental illness and highly pro-social people. And so that shows you that those kinds of people, group selected people, if you like, that are focused on the good of the group and that sort of thing, those people, it has a positive effect. And that makes sense. It would do. Why wouldn't it? If it's been practiced for the whole history that we know of humor, we know the Romans practiced this, then it would almost certainly be evolutionarily adaptive. And until about 1800, we were under harsh conditions of Darwinian selection, which meant we were all highly group selected. We weren't individualists. There are very few individualists. That's a new kind of thing. We were highly group oriented, high in conscientiousness and agreeableness, much more like sort of like the Japanese, cooperative people, high in trust and all this. And those kinds of people, their remnant population now, it has positive effects. When it's done in a certain ritualistic formal way, that makes sense. So that's what they were doing. That's what the whole of society was doing, but they were doing it in a very extreme and pronounced way with regard to the offspring of the upper class, because they wanted them to be particularly group selected. It was so important that these people were inculcated with these forms of behavior.
So they would identify with a group and be able,
yes,
be able to
precisely,
lead.
Precisely, exactly. Many years ago, when I was still doing my PhD, I was looking into jobs and whatever, and a friend of mine had got a job as a teacher an RE teacher at a public school, and he said to me, "Oh, well, you should. It's brilliant." He said, "You get your salary. You don't have to pay for any food. You it's absolutely brilliant. You should apply to teach at a public school just for a while. You'll love it." So I ended up I didn't get the job, but I had an interview at a girls' public school in Salisbury, and I had to go and teach a class. I had to go and teach about the Sermon on the Mount to a group of 13-year-old girls, and then I was chatting, of course, with the various teachers, and most of them had been to public school. And they were saying that the thing is, you don't have a sense of place if you go to public school. You have where you live with your parents, but you don't spend much of your time there, so you're not really from there. And you have your school, wherever that's going to be, but you're not really from there. So you're not really from anywhere. You're just from the empire or from England. And that's the idea. That's the point of it, so that you don't have a sense of geographical place that you identify with. You just identify with the nation. So that's part of why taking them away to school is a good idea. And it helps to break the bond with the family and any sense of place they might have as a child. And it helps to ensure that they have these group-oriented values. And that was the point. If you go back to the 20s and ask parents, well, how would you like your child to be? And they'll say, I want him to be obedient. I want, you know, that sort of thing. They want him to do things for the good of the group. Whereas now we say we want our children to be happy, to be content, whatever. That's for the good of the individual, not the good of the group. And so it makes sense that corporal punishment is dying out, because corporal punishment is a group selected thing. And increasingly the values that are dominant in our society are individualistic values like harm avoidance and equality, even between parents and children, rather than the group oriented values such as hierarchy and structure and loyalty to the group and things like this. And so you can see how it would go. And one thing that you would expect is that very, very group selected peoples that, like the British, there's research on this, highly, you know, under harsh levels of group selection, highly group selected, which leads to high levels of genius, because the more genius is per capita you have, the more you can beat another group in a war. Those kinds of peoples tend to be very, very pro corporal punishment. And that's what you find, that we are highly group selected. The Japanese are highly group selected. The Afrikaners, the Americans up against the Native Americans and whatever, highly group selected. And so they're resistant to getting rid of corporal punishment. Whereas groups which stopped being group selected quite a long time ago, or even the French were quite late getting rid of it. And groups which stopped being group selected quite a long time ago, they tend to have got rid of it. So, yeah, I think that's the point of the system. It was to create, and with Churchill, of course, and that's what Snake Kinnersley was doing in extremis. In his system, he was a high Tory. He was a extremely conservative. Even by the, he was Anglo-Catholic. He was extremely conservative and pro-empire and whatever, even by the standards of his time. And so he was really wanting to create these highly, highly, highly group-oriented people. But unfortunately, Churchill got ill. Interestingly, if you look at Churchill's behaviour, the early reports, his behaviour is appalling, and it gets better as he progresses through the score. So it's obviously working; it's having a positive effect. But then it's breaking him. It's a horrible term to use, but it's basically breaking him. So that he's a highly pro-social, and then he's taken away from there and brought up by some goes to some lovely school run by some elderly spinsters in Brighton, and the whole thing's undermined. And it is true that to the extent that psychopathic personality and whatever is genetic or is to do with things that happen very early in life, those things tend to come out later in a more pronounced form, because you're creating. When you're young, you're not creating your own environment, which is reflective of your own innate nature. So somebody else is creating it. And so therefore the heritability of these traits becomes lower. But once you are an adult, then you start to create an environment which is consistent with your own innate nature. So it could be argued that he would never these traits would just come out again when he was older. But that said, there is a sort of Pavlovian aspect to childhood, and childhood experiences can have lasting effects into adult life. And so it may well have been possibly the case that he wouldn't have been quite so rambunctious had he stayed longer under the care of Herbert, if that's the right word, of Herbert Snake Kinnersley. And so that's what I wonder about. And then if that had happened, maybe we wouldn't have had World War II, because World War II really was all Churchill's war, as Pat Buchanan has put it. And then, well, the empire would have collapsed anyway, but perhaps it wouldn't have collapsed quite so quickly.
If we still had the empire, then those lady teachers that were at that girls' school, they would still have had a sense of place. It seems to me as if the public school was set around producing these people for the British Empire. Now we no longer have the British Empire. What is the point of these people going to these schools? They end up not knowing where they're from or what they're for.
I think it's a good thing. If when I was at Durham University, it was about 40% private school, and of that about half were from public schools, even though public schools were about 4% of schools. So they were heavily overrepresented. Now, it was the people that were from private schools, not public schools, the private schools, the private day schools. They were insufferable because they had all the wealth and privilege and whatever, but they'd never suffered or wanted for anything a day in their lives. So they were these arrogant bastards, and they are the kind of people that have ascended to power now in Britain, people like them. Whereas at least the people that have been to the public schools, yes, they are incredibly privileged and whatever, but they'd been to school, particularly the men, the boys, and they'd undergone, at that age, I mean, I'm 40 now, so they still were beaten at school. Not as severely as with Snake Kinnersley, and they were allowed to keep their trousers up and whatever, but they were, and they tended to be much more reasonable, agreeable people in my experience, and they did have this sense of noblesse oblige, and a lot of them have in their work lives have subsequently displayed that. So I think that one of the you've got to distinguish within those that are at the public schools between the kind of public schools where the proper upper class go, like where Churchill went. So the kind of people that it was the most prestigious prep school in the country at the time, and you had the sons of dukes and whatever there. And then the more sort of upper middle class public schools, like where Tony Blair went, you know, FETs and places like that. You've got to distinguish between those. And I think it was the gentry class that were inculcated still with these and are still inculcated with these values of noblesse oblige and whatever through the kinds of prep schools and public schools that they go to, although this may be changing. And so 40 years ago, we still had some of these gentry people like William Whitelaw and Lord Carrington and people like that running the country. Who didn't go into politics because they were terribly ambitious. They just went into it out of a sense of noblesse oblige and whatever. And now those people have kind of gone. I mean, we don't really have people like that anymore. Perhaps Boris Johnson is someone a bit like that, or David Cameron. But a lot of them are just highly, highly ambitious and thus individualistic people. And so they don't have the good of their nation necessarily in mind at all. They haven't been beaten into believing that nothing's more important than the good of their nation. They're individualistic people that want as much power and money as they can, and they'll exploit politics to get it. So that it's a serious problem that those kinds of people are in charge in Britain, I think.
What do you make of Jacob Rees-Mogg? Because I would associate him with understanding noblesse oblige and identifying more with the nation than somebody like Boris Johnson, for instance.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Jacob Rees-Mogg does seem to be of a sort of an anachronism, and it was something he plays up to, but an anachronistic noblesse oblige type of politician. Whereas with Boris Johnson, you get the impression from things he said, like he once said, oh, they don't put up statues to the critics, that he really actively wanted to go into politics. He wanted to. David Cameron, I mean, to the extent that we can trust him, if you read his memoirs, it's quite clear that people were saying to him, you should go into politics, you should do this. And he wasn't sure. He was saying, oh, maybe I'm too young. So with him, it seems to be a sense of noblesse oblige. But with Boris Johnson, I get the impression that he's a kind of not particularly mentally stable character. That's how he seems to me. And motivated by some sort of crisis, I don't know, at some point he decided in his mid-30s, that he wanted to go into politics, but because he was already famous by then because of Have I Got News For You and whatever, that he was able to become the candidate for Henley without much difficulty.
What do you make of Boris Johnson then with his fascination with Winston Churchill? Do you think that's a fascination with the image that Winston Churchill has? Or do you think he actually knows the truth about Winston Churchill?
I don't know. His book on Winston Churchill was very, very bad. And indeed, Peter Jay, who told me that he wrote a letter to Boris Johnson, saying, because Boris Johnson described, this is another myth about Snake Kinnersley, that he was old. So Boris Johnson, the research in that book was so bad. He talks about them giving Snake Kinnersley being an old perv who would give children 10 strokes to the bare bottom with the cane. Right. Do you know, he must have got that from watching the film Young Winston. Because in the film Young Winston, Snake Kinnersley is played by Robert Hardy, who was 47 years old and looked older. And there's a scene in which Robert Hardy wields a cane to a boy's bare bottom. That's where he got that from. And it's not true. He used a birch, and Snake Kinnersley died aged 38. So of a heart attack. So he wasn't old. He was young. So that's the level of research involved in Boris Johnson's book, even in something like that, shows you that he hasn't researched it particularly well. And it was just a kind of a pot boiler. But I would suspect that he sees himself as a bit like Churchill. He'd like to be a bit like Churchill. And it's almost like a sort of hypnotism. By writing a book like that, he wants people to associate him with Churchill and think, oh, he's like Churchill. Boris, Churchill. And there are parallels, but he would like the charismatic outsider, a bit of a joker, whatever. I think that was kind of why he did it. But it's a very bad book. And Peter Jay actually wrote to him and said, what you've said about Snake Kinnersley is wrong. My grandfather wrote this memoir on it saying it was wrong. And when Churchill's memoir came out, And it was Churchill disguises the name of the he doesn't use the name of the school, and he disguises things for some reason. I don't know why. Somebody, I don't know who it would have been. It couldn't have been Stake Kinnersley's widow because he was dead, but she was dead by then. But it was some relative, I guess, wrote to Aubrey J and said, "Is this true? All these horrible things that he's saying about Stake Kinnersley?" And he was like, no, he was very, very popular. He was very, very popular. He was really loved, and he was an inspiring teacher. And don't listen to them. So yeah, I think it's just a bad book, and he just identifies him. William Hague, interestingly, wrote a biography of Pitt the Younger, and you can see how he'd identify with him because they both peaked very young. So that was an identification thing, perhaps as well. And they're both called William. But yeah, I think that's where that comes from with Boris.
I would much have preferred that he was interested in people like General Gordon or Baden-Powell rather than Winston Churchill. And I think when you look at characters like particularly General Gordon, I think he's the archetypal British Empire character, and he really cared about the people that he was governing, and he cared about the British as well. He really stood up for the Irish, he stood up for the natives out in Sudan. And then you contrast that with Winston Churchill, who was responsible for the Bengali famine and attacks in Afghanistan and
the Second World War.
Yeah. That as well. I mean, the contrast is massive.
Attacking miners. I mean, and there's a chap called Michael Dobbs, and he writes all these positive things about Churchill as well. Like all these myths, like that he kicked the headmaster's hat to pieces. I looked into that and the sources of that, and it's not true. It didn't happen. Or that he went back to the school after he had left, like years later, to find the headmaster and beat him up, and he discovered that the headmaster was dead. Right. That's another myth that's come from somewhere. It seems to have come from Sir Shane Leslie, who was Churchill's cousin. And the most I can think is it might have been a lie that Churchill told him, because when he went back to that school, it was under completely new management, and it was no longer the same school. And not only that, but Churchill, when he was in South Africa or something, lived with somebody called Hugo Baring. They were good friends, and they lived together. And they would have gone to the same prep school, albeit not at the same time. And I'm sure they would have talked about that because that's what public school people do. They go, where did you go to school? Where did you? And Hugo Baring would have known that Snake Kinnersley was dead. And I'm sure Churchill therefore knew at that time, so in 1900 or earlier, that Snake Kinnersley was dead. So that if he said that he went back there and he found out he was dead, that's just a complete lie. A lot of these things that he told Nita Leslie when he was senile anyway. Another thing I found was that he said he was arrested by General Berta. He writes his memoir that General Berta apprehended him when he was in South Africa. That turns out to be nonsense. It's just not true. And there's all kinds of things like that. I mean, I don't know how much of my early life you can believe. I mean, it's very well written, but basically it's just a sort of jolly good story, really.
Did you look into his ancestry at all? Because the theory is that because he didn't stay at this school, because he didn't have the same upbringing as these other great heroes of the British Empire did, he went bad. And that's the theory. But what about his ancestry? What about his heritage? What were his parents like? Did you look into that at all?
Who?
Churchill, his ancestry.
Yeah. Well, that's widely known. So we know that his father died in his early 40s, in his late 40s. We don't know what, I can't remember exactly what it was of. His mother was American, slight red Indian ancestry, as I understand it, and it goes back to the first Duke of Marlborough. And sort of quite parvenu. Interestingly, that's not the case with Snake Kinnersley. He had really ancient ancestry and could trace his family tree all the way back to the Norman Conquest, one of the few people in the country that could do so. So he had really ancient ancestry. But I don't know what impact that would have. But I've also traced all of Snake Kinnersley's life, so his childhood and where he went to, where he went to rugby, and then before that he was educated by in those days you used to have these people that would just set up little schools, and there was somebody called the Archdeacon of Wiltshire who was this elderly man who just set up a school in his house, and that was the prep school Sir Kinnersley went to, and then he married the Archdeacon of Wiltshire's daughter. Eventually, and Sir Kinnersley's father was a judge and a barrister, and I traced that back. But and then I've got in touch with relatives of his that are alive today. But no, I don't know what impact Churchill's ancestry would have. I mean, so, yeah, there's a heritable debate. His father does seem like a quite unstable individual, so in that sense, perhaps it's heritable. Also, I understand Churchill was born prematurely, possibly 2 months early. And that's associated with psychopathic personality and personality disorders and depression and things like that. So it could also have come from there.
What was the schooling like for just the average person back then? So if you're upper class, you would go to the prep school, you would go to the paid school. Was there any schooling around for the lower members of the British Empire?
We're talking in the 1880s. So schooling became compulsory in 1870 and free. But it wasn't really enforced in the countryside. So a lot of people that were in the countryside that were Churchill's age, born in 1874, would just not have gone to school at all. I know my great great grandmother was born in 1873, I think it was, and when she got married, her husband taught her to read and write. So that was the sort of lower class, and otherwise you'd go to school from the age of 5 to about the age of 10, at the time, Churchill's generation, and it would be free of charge, and then otherwise you had to pay, and then there were lots and lots of private schools because the standard of these state schools obviously was considered to be absolutely awful, and so most people even in the sort of middle class would go to or lower would go to private schools. You had these proprietary schools that were set up to make money, and that's what Sir Kinnersley's was, although it was a very very prestigious one. It was set up to make run at a profit. That was the point of it. And then you'd have the public schools, which were part of the headmaster's conference, which has ever grown. And then you just have these private schools that are modelled on the public schools. Some of them, most of them, day schools, but some of them where you were born. And that was pretty much the system. And then, of course, after that, it was very few people. And even in those days, I think even barristers, only about like 40% of barristers even had degrees. So degrees were incredibly rare. And then that was the system, yeah.
I think it was a great system that we had, a meritocracy in the time of the British Empire, and people would buy a promotion and they would work their way up, and you had a chance for people that were, say, a son of a cabinet maker in Glasgow could end up being the governor of India, because it was all based on merit, unlike today.
No, I'm not sure it was. I mean, a lot of it as well was to do with the right connections and things like that. I'm not sure that's quite true, but it is true that there was the beginnings of a grammar school system which allowed you to identify very bright people, and that had been in place for a long time. But no, I think it wasn't all based on merit. I mean, if it had all been based on merit, I don't think someone like Churchill would have got as far as he had so quickly. It was based on who you know. And this was, I think, a probably relevant. I look at this in the book. To dealing with these people, you have to realize that these people, through who they know and through the right connections, are going to become important in the British Empire. They are going to run the British Empire. So you have to make sure that they are instilled with the appropriate values and the appropriate ways of thinking and the appropriate behaviours in order to do so. So that's why it was so important, in a way, precisely because it wasn't based on merit. That's why it was so important that these people had, these aristocrats, had to be made to behave themselves.
I think the story there that I was referring to with the cabinet maker, somewhere along the way, he did bump into an aristocrat, and that gave him a help up as well. It was the idea that you could buy promotion back then.
Certainly, that was another thing that they said, that Sir Kinnersley was a snob. And I looked at this in the book, and I don't find I find evidence to be highly inconsistent with that. So if you look at the people that he employed as school teachers, one of them hadn't been to university, and it just seems to have been someone that Sir Kinnersley might have got to know through his connections with missionary work. Another one that he employed was just some sergeant who'd had to leave the army because he got injured or something. And he advertised in the Naval Gazette for a PE teacher. And this guy, just this ordinary working class guy who had been a sergeant in the army, was then employed at the school to teach physical education. And then there was this idea that Roger Fry put across where he said that Stoke Kinnersley was insecure intellectually and surrounded himself with people that were stupider than him. And so I looked at the evidence for that, and that's not true. These people that were the teachers at the school, they published books, they published novels. One of them had been professor of music at a London Academy of Music before Stoke Kinnersley employed him as a music teacher. So that's not accurate either. And there was one chap I found that was a teacher at the school who was some working class boy from Birmingham that had somehow got into a public school in Birmingham. And then Stoke Kinnersley employed him. So he wasn't a snob.
Well, he must have found that these people were good with the boys, and that's why he took them on, rather than anything else. I mean, that's what you'd be looking for, wouldn't it? Be somebody
Harry
that
Holmes,
was inspirational.
Son of a plasterer in Birmingham. So that's what you're looking for. It's just another myth, the myth of Churchill's appalling headmaster. You know, yes, he did beat kids severely. That's true, evidently, based on multiple attestation. Yes, he may have been a bit of a pederast, but then there's no evidence he acted on it. And I would argue, and I look at evidence of this in the book, that it's not uncommon for chaps that are a bit attracted to boys to go into school teaching. And he was nowhere near as bad as many of the other teachers that I look at in the school at the time, who were far worse, far more severe, and generally ghastly. And he was considered by most of those that he schooled to be a very positive influence. And so it's just another example of a Churchill myth. And I think we really do need to re-examine Churchill. I've just finished an article for an encyclopedia, has just been accepted, on Churchill's butler, Churchill's manservant, valet, Frank Sawyers. And I wasn't able to persuade the people who are his relatives living today to cooperate with me on this. And I think the reason is because they know that I've been critical of Churchill, and they obviously are part of the Churchill cult. And so many people are. But we have to reassess this guy. I don't think they should tear down the statues of him, but that's just because that's basically gaslighting and upsetting ordinary British people. But he was not a positive influence. He took us into an unnecessary war. He was a drunk. He was a he had psychopathic traits. He took risks on other people's lives, terrible risks on other people's lives. I think he was just in it for the power, really. And he wanted a war because he wanted to go down in history. We need to reassess Churchill. And the more time passes, the more we can do so, and the more it's becoming clear that he was not a very nice person.
Not at all. He certainly wasn't representative of the best of us. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Ed. That's absolutely fantastic. I've learned a lot there, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. Do you want to let our listeners know where they can find your work, where they can buy your books?
Oh, well, you can buy the book, The Jolly Herald. You can buy the book, The Churchill's Headmaster, from Amazon if you really want to fund evil. Or you can buy it from Waterstones or whatever, Barnes & Noble, or from the publisher, Manticore Publishing. And you'll go to my website, edwarddutton.wordpress.com. You can see a list of my books, which you'll be able to find them available in various places. Jolly Heretic, I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time. So you join me there.
And it is highly recommended indeed. I do recommend people join you there for the Jolly Heretic. Well, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.